I call it From Here to Eternity. The book of Revelation, John is writing this book. It's about 95 AD. And this is the only book in the Bible that tells us where it is written from. John was banished to the Isle of Patmos, and we find that in chapter 1, verse 9. It's during the reign of Domitian. A lot of the early disciples of that first group, particularly people like Timothy, will be martyred under the reign of Domitian. And Patmos is this desolate little rocky place. It's sort of like the ancient Alcatraz. About the only thing on it were a few quarries, and there was a seaport there that ships coming from Ephesus would sometimes stop and use. I think if anything, there was a movie out called Papillon, and there's one point on there where Papillon's stuck on this tiny little island. In my mind, that would be kind of what the Isle of Patmos looked like. That place. It's interesting they didn't kill John. Tradition tells us he was boiled in oil and didn't have any effect on him at all. Basically, the Isle of Patmos was used for political prisoners. And the crime, of course, that John will be accused of isn't political. The purpose of the writing of Revelation is to encourage hope. This is a book of hope among the churches. Domitian had demanded that his subjects worship him as Lord and God. And for the Christians, the choice was either deny Christ or be persecuted. And John's method of instilling hope is by revealing God's divine program throughout history and its ultimate victory. So he's looking at thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He's saying that we are not independent. We are not simply set free to chance over time, but that there is a divine plan, that God has not moved away. He has not left us. John is not a deist. He's a Christian. Now, the persecutions have begun. And because of that, because of the persecutions that are going on here, the message of hope in the book of Revelation is veiled. It's an extremely important book. There are over 400 allusions to the Old Testament and not a single quote. And all through here, be careful because you're trying to make an interpretation of an interpretation. And there are a lot of different interpretations of this book. I remember one time my roommate in seminary, our first year in seminary, decided that the book of Revelation would remain a mystery to us no longer. And I had a tape of it, and so we went for a long hike and listened to the book of Revelation. By the time we came back, we had discovered one thing. Both of us had become emotional pre-trib raptures. We voted that whatever was going on there, we hope God took us home before it happened. It doesn't look like a lot of fun. But we'll talk about that more in a minute. I'll tell you how to vote if it ever comes to a vote. Now, God's triumph over evil that is talked about in this book is to encourage real hope. This is not some sentimental speculation. And it's also to promote a vital living, that whole area of perseverance. And it opposes a dualistic view of history. It opposes an absolute dualistic view of history. Now, dualism says that there's good and bad. And absolute dualism says that they're equal. One will gain a little bit over the other one, and then that one will fight back, and the whole universe forever will go back and forth. It's this yin and yang kind of idea. The Bible says that's ridiculous. Jesus will fell Satan with a word. There's no contest here. None. But we do have what's known as limited dualism. Yes, there is the good side and the bad side. Clearly, the prince of this world is not good. He's the prince of darkness. He's the father of lies. Yes, we are in a spiritual battle. We are on occupied territory. And it's interesting because the messages to these seven churches, which is where most of us live in the book of Revelation, I think, the first three chapters, all end with a promise, a covenant to the people about what God will do. And as you look through these things, these first three chapters, characteristic number two of Revelation, contain the message to the seven churches. And each of these churches, the same churches that were in and around Ephesus, probably the same churches that general letter was written to, contain basic elements. And in each one of them, you find out something about Christ. There's a commendation to the people. There's also a condemnation. We have some counsel, a caution, and a promise made, a covenant with them. And as you work through these books, You can use this little outline to see what is happening in each letter to each church. Now, there are a couple churches for which there's nothing good to say. There's also a church where there's nothing bad said, so there's no condemnation on it. But the advice that's given is important advice. Take a look with me at the outline. The theme is encouragement, and the central focus of the book of Revelation is on Christ. One revelation, four visions. The first vision begins to talk about Christ and the seven churches, the glorified Christ. We get a picture of what Christ looks like today. Now, we just talked about the image that we have of Christ and how he looks. Well, there's another problem with that, because Jesus now is in his Shekinah glory. And we get John's attempt to wrap words around what the Shekinah glory looks like. And we have it right here. He says in verse 10, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like the sound of a trumpet saying, 'Write in a book what you see.'" Because remember, John doesn't like to write. "And send it to the seven churches. And I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the middle of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed in a robe reaching to his feet and girded across his breast with a golden girdle. And his head and his hair were white, like white wool, like snow. And his eyes were like a flame of fire. And his feet were like burnished bronze, which had been caused to glow in a furnace. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. And in his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. And his face was like the sun shining in its strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as a dead man." This is the image of what Jesus looks like now, the Shekinah glory. And then, as if this isn't enough, Jesus tells him who he is. He says, "Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last, the living one. I was dead. Behold, I am alive forever. I have the keys of death and of Hades. Write, John, what I'm going to tell you." And then he gives us the outline for the book. "Write, therefore, the things which you have seen, past, the things which are, present, and the things which shall take place after these things, future." I think this is the key verse to interpreting this book. Jesus says, write about the past, the present, and the future. And this book must be interpreted in light of those three things, the past, the present, and the future. He goes on and talks about the Christ and the earthly judgments. And we have here again John, his favorite number, seven. The seven spirits, the seven seals in chapter 6, the seven trumpets in chapter 8, the thunders, the bowls. And then we have Christ in his victories. And then we have Christ and his bride. We've moved all the way back to that whole analogy of marriage. But the picture that goes through here, we have the glorified Christ talked about in chapter 1, verse 12. In chapter 5, verses 4 through 7, we see him as the Lamb, the sin bearer. This is where we get the lyrics to our song that we sing about the Lamb is worthy. Good lyrics. We're going to be singing that song. We already know the words. And then in chapter 19, verse 11, we see him as the conquering king. And then in chapter 19, verse 16 and following, we see him as king and Lord. And we have this incredibly beautiful picture at the end of Revelation, where it says that I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he shall dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be among them." And then in verse 4, that relational aspect we have with God, "And he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall no longer be any death, there shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away." It's a picture of Jesus walking down the streets of the New Jerusalem, wiping away every tear, smoothing out every wrinkle of concern. Because the promise he had made way back, that "I will be your God, you will be my people, and I will dwell in your midst," that's been echoed over and over again, dozens and dozens of times, at key points in history, is now reality in the fullest sense. The schools of interpretation, one of the schools is called the preterist school. It's Latin for to pass by, and it means that the book of Revelation is of past history. It's from the reign of Nero through the fall of Jerusalem. It covers about a 7-year period. But while that is one of the views of interpretation, it misses the prophetic nature of the book that we talked about in chapter 1. You could also look at the prophetic nature in chapter 1, verse 3, and in chapter 22, verses 18 and 19. It's tough to leave out the predictive and prophetic side of it. There's another interpretation, general rubric for the book, and that is the idealist view. It says that Revelation depicts the symbolic struggle between God and Satan, and it focuses on the ethical and spiritual truths. In other words, it's not that any of this is really going to happen, or it's not predictive. It's just simply saying that there's a limited dualism going on here. The third view is the historicist view, which says that Revelation is the history of the church from John's time to the end of the world. And it's up to you to figure out where all these events happened. And that's an interesting view. It certainly includes the predictive elements, but what happened to the past and the present? And then there's the futurist view, which says that aside from the first three chapters, Revelation is the history of the future events to be fulfilled at the end times, immediately before the second coming. It's these last 7 years and 3.5 years that Daniel talks about. And I suspect that probably everyone in this room lives somewhere between 3 and 4 here on the perspectives. And if you do, then you have some views on the millennium, talked about in chapter 20. Let me real quickly cover these for you. One of the views is called the amillennial, and it simply says that 1,000-year reigns is figurative. It's non-historical. It's merely talking about the quality of time. It's like Pax Romana will reign for 1,000 years. It's not saying that it has to be literal. It's saying that it's the quality of time. The postmillennial view, which was very, very popular until the turn of the century, said that the church will reign for 1,000 years and then Christ will return. Things are going to get better and better and better and better until finally our experiential and positional are so close to each other, Christ will just step right in. In fact, that's what many of our forefathers thought, because they fought the war to end all wars. Talk about optimism. We now call it World War I. When we started numbering our world wars, we quit thinking of that. Although that view has been presented. In fact, I was in Houston when Millennium 73 occurred. Maharishi Jai, in the Astrodome, ushered in the millennium. You probably didn't know that. It began in the fall of 1973. Of course, that was just about the time of the oil crisis. That's just about the time when terrorism really started up big time. So much of the world's economy began to unravel. Interesting millennium. Of course, a few years later, his mom said he's really not God incarnate. It's his brother. She disowned him, and it's been a messy family situation since then. And there's the premillennial view that says Christ will return before the 1,000-year reign. And within that view, there's some other possibilities. There's the pre-trib, post-trib, and mid-trib. It's the idea that either Christ will return for us and we'll have the rapture, the great snatch, before the tribulation hits, or we have to wait through the entire 7 years, and after the tribulation, any of us who have survived, then we'll be raptured. And then there's the mid-tribulation for those who want to live in the middle ground. First 3.5 years, things are going to start getting tense, but they're not going to really be intense. And then we'll leave, and then everything unloads on us. Well, it's interesting. You know, I've heard a lot of people that are post-trib say, well, you know, may your beliefs be unto you as you say. Post-toasties could be a good key for you, who you are. But we don't really know. And it's interesting, too, because it seems to me that God frequently does not take us out of the tribulation, but gives us grace through the tribulation. However, emotionally, I say we all vote for a pre-trib rap. Yes. I think we don't need to be here. But let me give you the one argument I have found some solace in, but it's an argument from silence. Beware of arguments from silence. They don't prove anything. They just don't disprove something. It's kind of like the argument that Jesus was married. I don't think Jesus was married. But the Bible never says he wasn't married. It never says he was married. You understand what an argument from silence is? But the interesting thing is that the church disappears at chapter 4 and doesn't reappear again until chapter 19 when all this is over. I think it's interesting there's no comment about the church in here, which makes me think that perhaps the church is gone. But there's one other thing, because these tribulations come from the hand of our Father, not from Satan. All these things that are being poured out are from God. The tribulations and all the testing is from God. And that encourages me, because even if we're here, this is God's discipline on the world. This is the final crunch and the clash that brings the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of earth to one. And basically, the kingdom of earth is so badly shaken, it's like an old torn up garment that will be thrown out. Start over. There's another view. It's called realized eschatology. Now, this term has slipped a lot over the years, but realized eschatology simply says this: the time before Christ's return will find a clearer polarization of good and evil. And I think that realized eschatology is now the wrong term for what I'm talking about. That has become a liberal term. But one view of dispensation is that the world's going to just get worse and worse. And you've probably all heard that, particularly in light of the recent presidential campaigns. They're afraid that one person that would have a dispensational view of history would just as soon let things get worse and worse so that Christ came back. It's kind of like forcing God's hand. But at the same time, it seems to me that we live in an unprecedented time for spiritual renewal and hope. More people are coming to Christ today than ever before. And this particular view I call realized eschatology tries to deal with that. It's not merely just rescuing people out of a handcart on the way to hell as the world gets worse and worse, and there's nothing we can do about it. To say that we live in the best of times and the worst of times is an incredible spiritual renewal and incredible darkness. And the world is beginning to polarize more and more and more as we're drawing to these battle lines. And I see some good sense in that, and I just offer that up as a possible speculation for you.
Well, regardless of your point of view in terms of the interpretation of the book of Revelation, one thing is clear, and that's that the book is there to inspire hope. It's hope because the kingdom of heaven is going to crash in on the kingdom of this world and overwhelm it. The bridegroom is going to come back for his bride, the church. It's us. It's us. There are two basic worldviews. In one, it goes like this: what you see is what you get. There's nothing more to life than what meets the eye. And so when life presses in hard on you, well, oftentimes the world contemplates suicide. But for the Christian, it's a whole different story. For the Christian, when things press in hard, you can always at least pray for the second coming, because you know how the story's going to end, regardless of what happens in the middle. Sometimes when life presses in on me, I remember a little children's poem. It's called The Race. I have no idea who wrote it, but it goes like this. Quit. Give up. You're beaten, they shout and plead. There's just too much against you now. This time you can't succeed. And as I start to hang my head in front of failure's face, my downward fall is broken by the memory of a race, a children's race. Young boys, young men, how I remember well. Excitement, sure, but also fear. Wasn't hard to tell. They all lined up so full of hope, each thought to win that race, or tie for first, or if not that, at least take second place. And fathers watched from off the side, each cheering for his son, and each boy hoped to show his dad that he would be the one. The whistle blew and off they went, young hearts and hopes afire. To win, to be the hero there, was each young boy's desire. And one boy in particular, his dad was in the crowd, was running near the lead and thought, my dad'll be so proud. But as he speeded down the field, across a shallow dip, the little boy who thought to win lost his step and slipped. And trying hard to catch himself, his hands flew out to brace. And amid the laughter of the crowd, he fell flat on his face. So down he went, and with him hope. He couldn't win it now. Embarrassed, sad, he only wished to disappear somehow. But as he fell, his dad stood up and showed his anxious face, which to the boy so clearly said, get up and win that race. He quickly rose, no damage done, a bit behind, that's all, and ran with all his mind and might to make up for his fall, so anxious to restore himself, to catch up and to win. His mind went faster than his legs. He slipped and fell again. He wished that he had quit before with only one disgrace. I'm hopeless as a runner now. I shouldn't try to race. But in the laughing crowd he searched and found his father's face, that steady gaze that said so clear, "Get up and win that race." So up he jumped to try again, 10 yards behind the last. "If I'm to gain those yards," he thought, "I've got to run real fast." Exceeding everything he had, he regained 8 or 10, but trying so hard to catch the lead, he slipped and fell again. In defeat, he lay there silently. A tear dropped from his eye. "There's no sense running anymore. 3 strikes, I'm out. Why try?" The will to rise had disappeared. All hope had fled away. So far behind, so error-prone, closer all the way. "I've lost. So what's the use," he thought. "I'll live with my disgrace." But then he thought about his dad, who soon he'd have to face. "Get up," an echo sounded low. "Get up and take your place. You were not meant for failure here. Get up and win that race." With borrowed will, "Get up," it said. "You haven't lost at all. For winning's not more than this, to rise each time you fall." So up he rose to win once more, and with a new commit. For he resolved that win or lose, at least he wouldn't quit. So far behind the others now, the most he'd ever been. Still he gave it all he had and ran as though to win. 3 times he'd fallen stumbling. 3 times he rose again. Too far behind to hope to win, he still ran to the end. They cheered the winning runner when he crossed first place, head high and proud and happy, no falling, no disgrace. But when the fallen youngster crossed the line last place, the crowd gave him a greater cheer for finishing the race. And though he came in last, with head bowed low, unproud, you'd have thought he won the race to listen to the crowd. And to his dad he sadly said, "I didn't do so well." "To me you won," his father said. "You rose each time you fell." And now when things seem dark and hard and difficult to face, the memory of that little boy helps me in my own race. For all of life is like that race, with ups and downs and all. And what you have to do to win is rise each time you fall. "Quit and give up. You're beaten," they still shout in my face. But another voice within me says, "Get up, win that race." You see, folks, it matters not if you try and fail and try again. But it matters much if you try and fail to try again. Proverbs 24:16 sums it up. "The righteous man falls 7 times and rises again."